Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated, a weekly roundup of the who's who and the what's what in the arts and culture scene here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture reporter. Each week, we'll bring you conversations and stories about notable happenings in our little slice of the world. Today on Curated, we talk about the photography of Kate Lapides.
In my process, what I'm doing is observing and thoughtfully and carefully watching what's going on in a situation like that, and kind of trying to gather what is the tenor of the situation, what kind of energy is happening, how are these girls experiencing this and feeling it.
A director from Old Snowmass has his documentary on PBS.
Well, one of the major barriers to wildlife movement is the four-lane highway. With the high fences, the median strips, and a lot of traffic, it can really be an absolute stopper.
We speak with author Garth Greenwell, and we hear what it's like to work in an independent bookstore.
I've always been able to come here and feel like welcome, and feel that this is a place for discourse and exchange of ideas, and it's always been a really great place in that regard for this community.
All of that, plus our song of the week, and as always, the week in the arts. A quick rundown of the top things to see, hear, and experience this week in the Valley. That's all coming up on Curated from Aspen Public Radio News. For the Good Period is a group that provides education and resources to manage menstruation. Kate Lapides traveled with the group to Kenya in the fall of 2015 and documented the trip on her camera. Her pictures are currently on display at Colorado Mountain College in Aspen.
So take me there. You're kind of volunteering to go across the world to take some pictures. What went into that decision?
Oh, boy. It was an incredibly easy decision for me to make, actually. For many years, I did similar work with other organizations such as Save the Children, International Rescue Committee, that were working on different humanitarian issues around the world. I'm deeply passionate about the work, and I love doing it. I love photographing any kind of humanitarian story or any group that's helping alleviate some of the social problems in the world. I have not had the opportunity to do many trips since taking on a full-time day job with Colorado Mountain College. So when this opportunity arose to travel with Casey and the organization, it was a very easy decision to make, and I jumped at the opportunity. I love photographing abroad. I love working on stories with groups that are trying to make a little difference in the world. I feel vitally alive when I'm doing that work. And so when that opportunity was offered to me, I just jumped. It was a very easy decision to make. I like the experience of being in I wouldn't call it a vacation, this kind of work. It's often very long, challenging, dry, dusty conditions, often not very clean, and you may not necessarily have access to clean water, or sometimes very challenging living conditions, but the opportunity to be telling a story about someone who is in a challenging situation, especially in a country where there's a fair bit of struggle, is it's an experience in which I just feel deeply alive, for lack of a better way to describe it. So I always love any opportunity I can to go and do the work.
Now, tell me about, do you remember the first picture that you took when you got there?
Yes. The first pictures were really just of us when we started packing. We traveled over. We were the distribution for 1,000 pad kits that actually needed to be put together. So we had a day where we stayed in a small guest house in a kind of the central hub community in this region where we worked in Kenya, is called Chagoria. We stayed at a small guest house there, and we had to pack 1,000 of these pads into kits for distribution. So we pulled in 3 lovely Kenyan nurses to come help us. And I just started documenting there, just kind of easing my way into taking photos in a new country.
And how do you ease your way into taking photos in a new country?
I think what's important when you're in a new situation and a new culture with your camera is to be very aware of what the local energy and vibe is around photography, and even the fact of bringing out your camera can change the, in subtle ways, can change the dynamics of a situation. So when I'm in a new place, I always like to begin to do that slowly, and especially in a situation where it's not really threatening at all. The situation was just, you know, all day packing these kits with seven women, and it was, you know, just fun. But it kind of gives me a little sense of what the energy is going to be around that when we get into situations that are a little more sensitive, which the presentations with the girls are around a very sensitive topic.
What's the hardest part of shooting in that situation? Where it is a difficult situation, and also there are cultural differences.
The hardest thing, this situation was less less challenging in this respect, because we weren't going really deep into really painful, heavy material with the girls, and a really in-depth story. And it was also quite a significantly less painful situation than some other things places I've photographed and times. But I think that the most difficult thing is when you know something that someone, an experience that they're having, an emotion that they're having, something that they're talking about, perhaps in this situation, for example, when they were talking about some of the painful things that result from their dropping out of school, and the situations that sometimes leads to for them, it's really being aware that they're in a really emotionally vulnerable space. And a camera can be a really thoughtful tool, or it can almost seem a little bit appropriative and like a weapon if not used thoughtfully and carefully. So I really try to be aware of that when I'm photographing, and use that tool really sensitively. The hardest thing for me is often that because a compelling image is reliant on capturing that one moment where someone's face is truly expressive and they are really sharing something that is very vulnerable and possibly painful for them, right at that moment when you really need to press the shutter to capture that, to communicate in a very strong way the experience they're going through, I always want to kind of reach out and touch their shoulder and give them some kind of comfort. And that's always been a huge challenge for me, especially in situations where people are sharing things that are truly painful for them.
So talking about seeing people in moments of emotion and times when they might be vulnerable, there's one picture that depicts a distribution lineup where you're handing out these materials, and the first girl in line has a mix of like fear and curiosity, and then there's another child behind her with her hands on her shoulders, kind of peering over and seeing what's going on. Tell me about capturing that image and that situation, and what that day was like.
That day was full of energy and excitement. That particular distribution was to 300 girls, which was never the intention. Those girls were from about 5 different schools, and many of them walked from miles away to come to that distribution. And the reason it happened with 300 girls out in a large field instead of in the classrooms in smaller groups was because the Kenyan school teachers went on strike about 2 weeks before we made the trip. So we had to do some last-minute scrambling and redirects. And that was the only place we could gather all those girls together and still do the distribution and the education session. So that moment, what I'm doing is observing and thoughtfully and carefully watching what's going on in a situation like that, and kind of trying to gather what is the tenor of the situation, what kind of energy is happening, how are these girls experiencing this and feeling it, and then just watching. I think photography is so much about watching and observing and an enormous amount of patience to wait for just that expression or that moment that when you see it through your lens, it's just intuitive, you know that's it, and you press the shutter button and you capture that. And for those girls, that's exactly what that day was like. It was a mixture of excitement and nervousness and uncertainty about something new that was getting introduced into their lives, and people who were telling them something new about themselves and something that could empower them. And so I think that that frame really captured that day for me, just that one moment, that microsecond between these two girls. And they were waiting in line to get their pad kits after we, the health educators had been talking to them probably for about 45 minutes or so.
And you also talked about reaching out to people in that moment. Was this a situation in where you did that or you were able to?
Not so much in this moment, because again, this large distribution, I would say, was a lot less intimate, you know, just because of the number of girls. In some of the other distributions that we did, they were in small classrooms, maybe with 10 to 15 girls. And so you're in a small circle, and the girls are very shyly sharing some of their more painful experiences. Some of the girls, when they some of the girls received some pressure to not only to drop out of school, but possibly sometimes to engage in coercive sex with older men. Some of the girls in this region also have some pressure for a cultural practice in that region called FGM. That's very devastating for them.
Right. And by FGM, you mean female genital mutilation? Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And so when they're very shyly sharing that and I'm holding up the camera, that's the moment when I want to, I have that tension myself between I want to reach out and just let them know it's okay. And we understand that you're sharing something that's really personal and scary, and we're here to help you. But instead, I really have to stand back and sort of be in that role of journalist.
All right, Kate Lapides, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Kate Lapides. Her photography is on display at Colorado Mountain College in Aspen. Independent Bookstore Day was on Saturday. People across the country celebrated by supporting these booksellers who survive in a tough industry. I went to find out what it's like to run one of these stores in the age of Amazon and Nook. Carol O'Brien was a lawyer, but had reached a point where she couldn't deal with the moral pressure of the job.
I came up against the philosophical question of, can I be a good lawyer and a good person both?
No, she couldn't. So she found work at a Walden Books. Then she made the jump to the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, the Cherry Creek location. The independent bookstore environment was a magical experience for her.
I felt at home in that environment. There was room for all kinds of different people. You didn't have to fit a mold to work there. You didn't have to wear a uniform to work there. You could have piercings or tattoos or purple hair or whatever you wanted, and it was pretty much okay.
And now she finds herself at BookTrain, a small store that faces right onto Grand Avenue. Independent bookstores are personal, she says. It's all about the connection she has with the people that come into her store and the books they leave with. In Aspen, people are having the same experience. When Ellie Scott came to the Valley 7 years ago, the first place she went was Explore Booksellers. The Victorian feel in the literature section were highlights.
Did you buy something that day?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know if I actually did that day. I should say yes, I probably did, but I actually don't know. I can't remember.
But what she knows for sure is what independent bookstores do for herself and the community.
I've always been able to come here and feel like welcome and feel that this is a place for discourse and exchange of ideas. And it's always been a really great place in that regard for this community.
Back at BookTrain, Carol O'Brien says working in an independent store can be challenging, especially when you can order a book online and have a digital copy instantly, or the real thing in a day or two. The real pride in being a part of a place like BookTrain comes from moments like this.
I had a gentleman come in. He was looking for a book for his wife for her birthday. So we talked a little bit, and I said, how about this one? And I showed him one of my favorites. Well, a few days later, he called me on the phone to thank me and tell me how much she loved that book.
It's just one relationship forged through a love and appreciation of the independent bookstore.
This week's guest for First Draft is Garth Greenwell. Greenwell is the author of the novel What Belongs to You, which tells the story of an unnamed narrator and his relationship with a male hustler named Mitko. Their connection is fraught with violence, lust, and ambiguity. In this segment, Greenwell tells host Mitzi Rapkin about the nature of transactional sex and what that means in the book.
Yeah, so, you know, that was one of the things I really wanted to explore in the book. I wanted to write about sex work in a way that recognizes how complicated and fluid and often ambiguous sex work is, especially in a gay context. And, you know, I think it's really hard to say anything that's adequately complicated about sex work. But I do think that sex work between men is structurally different from sex work in a heterosexual context for one reason, because the roles are so fluid. I mean, it's, you know, it's the case that, you know, many, many, many gay men have been on both sides of that transaction in various ways. And also, I think it is often ambiguous in the ways that you talk about, like transactional sex between Mitko and the narrator. You know, it's often the first scene where the narrator actually gives him money in exchange for a sex act is, I think, the only time that happens, where, you know, there is this sort of clear, I will do this for X amount of money, or I will let you do this for X amount of money. I think that's the only time that happens in the whole book. And actually, you know, transactional sex, and I think this is true in the world, is very often much more kind of casual and fluid. And it might involve, you know, a ride somewhere, a place to sleep for a night, or, you know, or something even more ambiguous than that, so that it's not even clear to what extent what's happening between these people kind of is a transaction and to what extent it's something messier and more complicated.
When they first got together, the narrator says that he's going from one category of erotic object to another. Can you talk about this line?
Yeah, so, I mean, right, so that happens in the context of their first meeting, and the two men, they meet in a public toilet beneath Sofia's National Palace of Culture, and this is a real place. It's a very famous gay cruising place where men go for sex. And, you know, when Mitko first makes clear that he might be available to the narrator in exchange for money, the narrator immediately says no, just as a reflex, and he tells us that, you know, he often gets these kinds of proposals or propositions in the places that he goes. I mean, he's someone who has spent a lot of time in cruising places, and that he's always said no. But he realizes that, you know, that's not because he disapproves of sex work in some way. It's because of pride, and because, you know, he's always felt like, I don't need to pay for sex. But he's getting older. You know, he's not old in any way, but, you know, he has a sense, I think, of time passing, and he has a sense, you know, there is, I think, a sense in him that of kind of missed chances. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, part of what, you know, makes him available to this relationship with Mitko is that, you know, he has a sense of himself as, you know, not being as desirable as he once was.
So you mentioned that the National Palace of Culture is a big gay cruising spot, which is interesting to me. I'd like to know more about that location. But I'm also just sort of curious about the human architecture of cruising spots. Just tell me more about what they're like and what men encounter there and why maybe that might be interesting for you.
So, right. I mean, cruising has been central to my life since I was 14. I mean, as a gay kid in Kentucky in the early 90s, these cruising places, and especially this park in Louisville called Cherokee Park, that was where I came into my identity as a gay man. And it was where, you know, I first experienced queerness as not just a source of shame, but a source of joy. And, you know, I want to write about these places in a way that recognizes their richness and recognizes the fact that, you know, they enable communities and sustain lives. You know, the bathroom in Sofia, which, as I say, is a real place and which I found by accident, you know, one day wandering the city And I and a friend, a straight friend, a colleague of mine at my school, we just needed a place to go to the bathroom, and we happened to be passing beneath. So in Bulgaria, you know, there are these big avenues, and to cross them, you go underground through these little sort of underground passageways that are called podlezi. And we just saw a sign for the bathroom. And so we were already underground. And then to get to the bathroom, you have to go much further underground. I mean, it's a very striking thing. You really descend far. But as we started descending the stairs, there wasn't anyone to see. There weren't any noises. There wasn't anything. But I turned to my friend and I said, men are having sex here. And I was right. And it was the most bizarre experience because, you know, this was just the first few weeks that I had been in Sofia. I barely spoke survival Bulgarian. Everything above ground kind of baffled me. The social mores are so different. I was constantly making faux pas and, you know, giving signals I wasn't intending. And then I descended into this space where I was absolutely fluent because the codes of cruising were exactly the same as the codes in Cherokee Park when I was 14. And that experience of sort of, you know, not just familiarity, but almost something like homecoming in this very foreign place was what gave rise to the novel.
That was Garth Greenwell, author of What Belongs to You. He spoke with First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin. You can hear their entire conversation on aspenpublicradio.org. You can also subscribe to the First Draft podcast on iTunes. James Brundage is the director of Wild Ways, Corridors to Life. The film aired on PBS last week. It follows the story of how humans are affecting natural migration routes for large mammals and how that affects their dwindling populations. I spoke with James ahead of the movie's premiere. Well, James, your film Wild Ways, kind of one of the main points it makes is that large mammals are at risk. Why is that?
Large mammals, and really every species, are at risk because their habitats have been fragmented, and that means they've been chopped up into little pieces.
I want to play a clip from the film that kind of outlines one of the problems that these animals that in these isolated situations are facing.
Two major highways cut across Yellowstone to Yukon, Interstate 90 in Montana and Idaho, and the Trans-Canada Highway, which runs right through Banff National Park.
So there are some highways going through a section of land running from Canada down into the United States where people are kind of suggesting that we in some way connect these concentrations of animals again. And can you tell me about that plan a little bit more?
Well, one of the major barriers to wildlife movement is the four-lane highway. With the high fences, the median strips, and a lot of traffic, it can really be an absolute stopper.
And why is that a problem?
Habitat fragmentation is a real problem for wildlife for several reasons. The most obvious one is inbreeding. If a population can't get in and out of a protected area, inbreeding sets in, and that really weakens the species. It makes them very susceptible to disease, and a species can be eliminated from one area. But if it's an isolated island of habitat, then there's no neighboring population that can resettle that area, and that species is gone forever. And we've seen that happening in our national parks all over the world.
Speaking of going all over the world, there's a large segment of the movie that takes place in Africa and talks about poaching.
If poaching exists, wildlife will not move. Communities can provide land. Governments can provide man and resources. But if we don't deal with poaching, wildlife will not move.
Is that another issue that animals face? We also talked about in the film the killing of wolves.
Well, the big picture that we're looking at is called connectivity conservation, which is really linking the protected areas around the world to make a functional larger landscape that animals can survive in. The first thing you need for this to work, though, is safe core areas to connect, like our national parks and wilderness areas. In other places of the world, notably South America and Africa, the parks need to live off just gate receipts, and that is not enough to protect the animals, especially in the face of the giant epidemic of poaching, which is now taking place.
And one final thing, when people see your film, what do you hope that they take away from it?
People need to learn to live with wildlife. And that takes a variety of things. And in our part of the world, part of it is just managing your garbage so there's no human and bear interactions that end up with the bears getting hurt. Humanity has occupied almost all the planet. And I think going forward, we need to take a step back and accept that we are one species among many and that we need to leave room for the other earthlings.
All right. Thank you very much, James.
You're welcome, Patrick. Nice to be here.
That was James Brundage, director of Wildways, Corridors to Life. You can see the movie on pbs.org. You're listening to Curated from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. Follow Aspen Public Radio on Twitter or Instagram, or like us on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick B. Fort. Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated on Aspen Public Radio. For this week's Song of the Week, we've decided to celebrate National Press Freedom Day, which is tomorrow, May 3rd. We've gone with a rap group that's very outspoken about these issues, Atmosphere. This is their song, Party for the Fight to Write. Just another face head bobbing nobody, but from where I stand, they sound like spies, filling all the children's heads with lies. Well, all right, get your money right, but right now tonight, I want you to pick a side. So when you got your power and you got your cheddar, let's get together, soldier, overthrow this hold and make these roads better. Bring it on right now. He said, bring it on right now. He looked you in the eye and he said, bring it on right now. Ain't nothing but a party, y'all. Let's get it on. Some got pencils and some got guns. Some know how to stand and some of them run. We don't get along, but we sing the same songs. Party for the Fight to Write. That was Party for the Fight to Write by Atmosphere. It's Monday, May 2nd, and this is the Week in the Arts, an abbreviated list of the upcoming events and happenings in the Valley. Miles Ahead is being screened by Aspen Film at the Isis Theater on Wednesday. Don Cheadle plays Miles Davis in this biopic that follows the jazz great through his rise from the days of blues to his acid jazz period. Wednesday at the Glenwood Railroad Museum, get a bit of history on laundry trains. In the late 19th century, trains would bring people from camps and ranches all over the state to Glenwood Springs. The presentation is being led by a man who has studied the history of Colorado's railroads. Let Them Roar plays at Marble Distilling Company in Carbondale on Thursday. The rock group features twangy voices with upright bass and electric guitar. It's folk with a bit of improvisation. Thursday is a big day for Carbondale. Colorado Creative Industries hosts its annual summit in the town. Carbondale is currently in the process of applying to become a certified creative district. If accepted, Carbondale would be eligible for state funding to support the arts. The Aspen Community School puts on a performance of its all-school play at the Wheeler Opera House on Friday. The show, The Sunday Funnies, follows comic strip characters as they try to solve the problem of their dying habitat, the newspaper. Saturday at Lions Park in Basalt, Jazz Aspen Snowmass holds its annual band battle. It's a high school battle of the bands. The winning groups and singer-songwriters receive studio time. For more on arts and culture in the Roaring Fork Valley or to list your event, go to aspenpublicradio.org. This is Curated, a weekly show dedicated to arts and culture. I'm Patrick Fort at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.